Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
And welcome to Africa Link. I'm Isaac Mugabe in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, the government in South Sudan and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar agree on a ceasefire to prepare for talks after fighting displaces residents of Bol.
I just cannot imagine that there is much left of Bol. The civilian population must have fled in all directions, which means they are at enormous risk. Maybe they will not have a big chance to survive.
Also on the program, a German doctor working in Liberia receives Germany's Order of Merit, one of the country's highest accolades.
I'm very delighted that I got this award, the sign of appreciation from the government of Germany and of course also from the embassy here in Monrovia.
These stories and more to come in this edition of Africa Link, straight from the studios of Deutsche Welle here in Bonn, Germany. Stay with us.
Top story.
Let's begin with South Sudan, where the government and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar have agreed on a ceasefire as they prepare for talks to end violence. There were no details as to when exactly the ceasefire would take effect. On Tuesday, the rebels claimed to have recaptured the key town of Bol after a pre-dawn assault on government forces. Could the talks between Kiir and Machar end the conflict, which has so far claimed more than 1,000 lives? I put that question to Peter Schumann, former director of UN mission in Sudan.
Well, I think there are some possibilities that the fighting may stop. It will not resolve the conflict. I think at the moment we're talking more about trying to find a way to stop the actual fighting taking place. Bol by now must be a totally destroyed place. What I have heard, what is going on, who's fighting, the way the fighting goes on, I just cannot imagine that there is much left of Bol. The civilian population must have fled in all directions, which means they are at an enormous risk. Maybe they will not have a big chance to survive.
Bol is under control by the rebels. Do you see any possible withdrawal by peaceful means?
I don't think so. I think we have to be very careful when we say Bol is under control. Bol is spreading into a lot of different directions. There is the road out to the airport. There is the way along the Nile. So who is controlling which part is very, very difficult. And it's not sort of the classical war where you control territory, where you have a clear front line. It is too many different groups fighting. I assume that with the talks going on in Addis, there may be a bit of a sort of a lessening of the military pressure, but I don't think that the military action will stop with the talks starting in Addis.
The African Union has threatened targeted sanctions on all those who incite people to violence along ethnic lines. Who does the AU have in mind?
Well, you know, I've asked myself the same question. Targeted sanctions means normally against institutions of government and possibly private business. So this would hit much more the government, which controls most of the business activities. I think this is more political rhetoric than a real threat. The African Union does not have the instruments to implement sanctions. They will have to address this question to the Security Council. I'm very doubtful that the Security Council will follow up on the question of sanctions at this stage.
And how do you evaluate the mediation efforts by regional powers, in particular Uganda?
I'm very skeptical. No, the mediation efforts by the region are not really following one line. Museveni has taken his own line, a very hard-line position, against Riek Machar. This can only be understood if you look at the history. The relationship between Riek Machar and Museveni has always been very, very complicated. Riek Machar's role was the LRA's threatening the stability in Uganda. So there's a big history. Also, the efforts taken by the other leaders in the region, they look strong from the rhetorical point of view, but I don't see a clearly united position between Ethiopia, between Kenya, between Uganda and others addressing the political question which is behind the conflict. If you look at the response from the region, when the press conferences took place from the government side, from the internal opposition within the SPLM, the region was very quiet. Now, all of a sudden, they talk about maybe power sharing, maybe other solutions. The region must become active, but I don't see a solution coming out from this IGAD statement.
I was speaking to Peter Schumann, a former director of the UN mission in Sudan. Now, early on Tuesday, rebels claimed to have recaptured the key town of Bol after a pre-dawn assault on government forces, a claim that was disputed by the army spokesman, Philip Aguil. I spoke to DW correspondent James Shimanyula, and I started by asking him about the strength of Riek Machar's forces.
It's a powerful outfit. In fact, the army was drawn from a ragtag fighting force and given a quick training of handling guns, thanks to their experience of also using poisonous spears and bows and arrows. The White Army, so-called for painting their bodies with ashes and cow dung, comprises more than 30,000 young men of Nuer tribe. So it's a powerful outfit, I would say.
Can the rebels consolidate their positions, or it's just a matter of time before they are dislodged from the town of Bol by the South Sudanese army?
The White Army, now turned rebels, are being assisted by mercenaries from another troubled region of Darfur in North Sudan. You know, Darfur is in the Republic of Sudan on the other side, on the western side of South Sudan. And with their commander being a military man, he's called Peter Yank Gadet, they are likely to put up a fierce battle, Mr. Mugabe, before they are actually dislodged from Bor, as you said rightly, the capital of Jonglei State, which is the biggest state in South Sudan.
How was it possible for the rebels to take control of Bor, given the superiority of the government forces?
Well, it was possible because they were assisted by, as I said at the outset, mercenaries from Darfur, and they belong to JEM. You know JEM, that is the Justice and Equality Movement, the one that has been fighting in Darfur for more than 20 years. And they are well experienced. And then in addition to soldiers, you remember the ones that defected from the National Army shortly after the attempted coup, they joined Peter Gadet and this White Army. So it's a strong, you know, team of fighters.
James Shimanyula in Nairobi telling us the strength of rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar in South Sudan.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
In Liberia, a German doctor has received Germany's Order of Merit, one of the country's highest accolades for her humanitarian work. Margaret Giratz Nimene, who operates a clinic outside Monrovia that caters for the less fortunate Liberians, received the award for her charity work during the country's 14-year civil war. Our correspondent, Julius Kanuba, has been finding out more about the life and work of Margaret Giratz Nimene.
I am taking a draft to the German Liberian Clinic in Pinsville, on the outskirts of the Liberian capital, Monrovia. This clinic, as the name suggests, was established in 1985 by a German, Margaret Gerhard Nimene, and her late Liberian husband, Dr. Dumbo Nimene. Commonly known as GELAP, the clinic was set up partly as a charity, offering low-cost medical services to less fortunate Liberians. For this charity work, Gerhard Nimene, now aged 62, has just received Germany's Federal Order of Merit in recognition of her years of work in Liberia. This spans nearly three decades, some including the difficult and bitter moments when Liberia was plunged into a brutal civil conflict. The award makes Margaret pleased.
I'm very delighted that I got this award and the sign of appreciation from the government of Germany and the people of Germany, and of course also from the embassy here in Monrovia.
The 14 years of war took their toll on her family. Between 1989 and 1990, her husband was attacked by marauding rebel fighters, an attack that would later contribute to his death 6 years later.
We experienced also a negative during the war. My late husband was attacked by the rebels and he developed epileptic attacks and later on Alzheimer.
And when actually he died?
On the 28th of January 1998.
Despite this ordeal, Gerhard Nieminen has continued to run her charity, the German Liberian Clinic. It has a staff of 24 and on average treats more than 1,500 patients per month. Gerhard Nieminen took me on a tour of the clinic, which was constructed with assistance from the German embassy and her friends.
This is our delivery department.
So how many deliveries do you have per day or per month?
Not per day. Yeah, sometimes we have two a day, especially in the night, but it differs.
So why you want to live in Liberia and not Germany?
Yeah, because now I set up Efficink here and I have a lot of people and children who are supported by me.
Julius Kanuba reporting on the remarkable work of a German doctor in Liberia who received Germany's Order of Merit.
Africa on the move.
Ghana has begun producing power from its second largest hydroelectric dam project, which is nearing completion. The dam will add 400 megawatts to the country's national grid. In the meantime, residents nearby have refused to vacate the area for resettlement elsewhere to allow for the completion of the entire project. DW correspondent in Accra, Isaac Kalechi, visited the project and sent this report.
Wee Dam is Ghana's second largest hydroelectric plant, and it is located on this serene landscape north of the country. Ghana's first and largest hydro plant, Akosombo Dam, was built in the 1960s under first president Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, constructed in collaboration with Sinohydro, a Chinese construction company. Wee Dam will provide an additional 400 megawatt hydroelectricity to Ghana. Work on the main dam began in December 2009, but it was not until in May 2013, when the country was hit by frequent power shortages, that the first generator was installed. According to Kweku Sapon Akosa, a civil engineer at Wee Power Authority, all three phases of the project have so far been implemented.
We have what we call the powerhouse, and the powerhouse is where electricity normally is generated. So for the 400 megawatts Wee Power project, this is where the 400 megawatts of electricity is going to be produced. We have the intake, which consists of three slots, and that is where the water is going to pass to hit the electromechanical equipment, which will later convert those energy, as in hydraulic energy, into electrical energy, which will later come to our homes.
The entire project is expected to be completed in 2014. Ghana's Energy Minister, Emmanuel Amakofibua, told me this final phase of the project will translate into significant benefits for the country. Bua believes this latest hydroelectric project will solve Ghana's long-term energy crisis.
It is really going to address our peaking challenges. Adding almost 20% to our generation capacity is a very serious and important project for our country in terms of our power generation.
Many Ghanaians have welcomed the Wee Dam project, but not the over 1,000 that had to be resettled. When I visited a Wee town in the Bono Ahafo region, there was little activity taking place in this village called Dukasina. They had gone to their farms since they are farmers. Only a few had gathered under a mango tree, women and boys singing to celebrate their annual mango harvest. This community remains the only one yet to be relocated because they have refused to vacate the area. They have gone to court over the matter. The over 120 community members here say they have not agreed on proper compensation with the government yet, hence they will continue to live here. Papa Sekwa told me they hope to win the matter in court because they have a better case against the government.
We have nothing against government. We are mere farmers and want proper compensation before we leave here so our children don't suffer in future. This is our land and we want the right thing to be done.
Local chief of Dukasina, Nana Edward Domaka, told me that the government has not been fair to his people in the compensation negotiations. I put that claim to Energy Minister Emmanuel Kofi Bua, who denied it completely. He told me he has done everything he can to provide proper resettlement for residents of Dukasina.
If you look at the relocation of these farmers, housing programs for them, the resettlement package, a lot has been done. We still have pockets of issues, especially dealing with issues of compensation. These are all issues that we are all focused on, and we are addressing, and we are going to finish.
That report was compiled by Isaac Kalechi in Accra. Now, the Democratic Republic of Congo is one country in Africa that has been racked with violence and conflict for decades. A six-year war known as Africa's World War left 3 million people dead. It also became known as the war which used rape as a weapon, affecting thousands of women. While a fragile peace was negotiated a decade ago, conflict has carried on in the east of the country along with the rapes. Deborah Kabungulu is a survivor of the conflict in her country. A midwife and mother of six, she watched as her husband and activist Pascal Kabungulu was murdered in front of her and her family. When her life became endangered, she fled with her six children, eventually settling in Canada. Deborah Kabungulu tells Sean Griffiths her harrowing story.
Deborah Kabungulu is at her home cuddling her first grandchild, Clara, and chatting away happily with her son, Eri, and his wife, Marie. It's a pretty normal family scene which portrays the huge resilience and strength of this petite 56-year-old woman, barely 5 feet tall. She still recalls vividly the terrifying, life-changing event of July 31st, 2005.
At 3:30 in the morning, we heard a noise. I thought they were thieves. I heard a cry from one of my sons, Maman.
Il avait crié, Maman!
Deborah called out to Patrick, then 15, but a gunman was threatening to kill him if he answered. He was trying to get Patrick to divulge where his father was.
My husband heard noises. He got up and opened the door. A man said, It's you we're looking for. He asked, Why are you looking for me? The man replied, You escaped often, but today it's finished for you. You won't escape. We will kill you.
And then they shot her husband, Pascal, in cold blood, in front of Deborah and her children. Pascal had been a human rights defender since the early 1990s, after witnessing the genocide in Rwanda where he worked as a teacher. Deborah says that he was profoundly affected by what he had seen in Rwanda.
People were killing each other. There were bodies everywhere, just everywhere. He saw people with machetes, people killing each other.
In 1995, Pascal started working with Héritier de la Justice, a human rights organization. He started writing newsletters for them before rising to become the head of the organization in 1998. The instability in Rwanda had spilled over the border into what was then eastern Zaire, where the Kabungulu family lived. Rebel Tutsis started launching raids across the border, hunting Hutu militias. Many civilians died getting caught in the crossfire or were targeted because they were mistaken for fleeing Rwandan Hutus.
People were getting killed, raped. There were people massacring everyone in cars.
Pascal was busy investigating human rights abuses because he hoped that one day the information would be important to bring those responsible to justice. Within days of Pascal's murder, his enemies came looking for Deborah. They turned up at the health center where she worked as a midwife, but fortunately she wasn't there. With no time to say goodbye and still grieving the loss of her husband, she and her family fled DRC with just the clothes on their backs. After spending a year waiting in Uganda, they were accepted as refugees by Canada in 2006.
Sian Griffiths with that report.
Making a difference.
In Zambia, regular jobs are scarce. Many university graduates are finding it difficult to get any sort of employment, and so one of the smaller political parties has hit on what it believes could be the beginnings of a solution. They say it involves creating opportunities for self-employment. The work is hardly glamorous or well-paid, but there is plenty of it around. Kathy Sukombi has more.
Lusaka, capital of Zambia and home to 2 million people, has a problem. The city generates more than 1 million tons of garbage a day, but only half of it is collected by the local authorities. The Forum for Democracy and Development, a small opposition party, has responded by training new garbage collectors. So far, 100 young people have been taught how to do the job, five of whom have started their own garbage collection companies. Under the project, and in cooperation with Lusaka City authorities, 2,000 households are now benefiting from this service, which party spokesperson Antonio Mwanza sees as politics in action.
Forum for Democracy and Development, FDD, as a political party, realizes the very important fact that you do not need to wait to be in government for you to contribute meaningfully to personal and communal development of the people. We set up a business entity called Neighbor's Friend, with very two specific objectives. Number one, to ensure that we fight poverty at household level. Number two, that we equip women and youth with self-survival skills.
Neighbor's Friend, to which Mwanza was referring, is a Lusaka-based social enterprise. George Piri is the director of programs for Neighbor's Friend and is convinced it will go a long way towards helping to create employment for young people in the country.
People are beginning to realize that you cannot always depend on the government for employment. Employment can be created by yourself. And the area of waste is one area where, if it is well harnessed, there are millions and millions of kwachas lying idle in that industry.
23-year-old Christabel Mulenga, a university graduate, is one of the beneficiaries of the project.
It's a good program that they've brought up because it has really helped us. Some of us are graduates and we can't find jobs. You know, looking at our country, Zambia, kind of messy. And so we thought of collecting garbage, just brought up this idea. And looking at young ladies doing such job, it's rare because everyone is thinking it's all about the white collar job. You need to be in the office because you're a graduate. You can't collect garbage, which is not true. You can do anything.
A report by Kathy Sikombe in Lusaka. And before we leave you so you can enjoy the new year, a reminder of the stories that we've covered in the last 25 minutes. The government in South Sudan and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar agree on a ceasefire to prepare for talks. In Liberia, a German doctor has received Germany's Order of Merit, one of the country's highest accolades for her humanitarian work. We've also been hearing how university graduates in Zambia started their own garbage collecting firms instead of waiting for white-collar jobs from the government. For comments and suggestions, as usual, send an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, a letter to AfricaLink, DW53110, Bonn, Germany, or an SMS to +49160 957 59510. This time tomorrow, Crispin Mwakidewo will be here with you to look back at events that shaped Africa in the year 2013. Do join him when you can. And on behalf of the entire AfricaLink team and, of course, the production team that has been instrumental in putting together the AfricaLink program, I take this opportunity to wish you a prosperous new year 2014. From Bonn, I'm Isaac Mugabe.